Hi, welcome to Motorcycle Views with me, Dave Marsden, here on Fab Radio International, brought to you by Z-Power, Kawasaki parts specialist. This show is all about news, views, information and anything else going on in the motorcycle world. We'll have guests, tips, travelling advice and reviews on anything motorcycle related. You can email us at motorcycleviews@yahoo.com. I'm joined also by my wonderful producer, Michelle. So let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to Show 12. On this week's show, we've got part two of our interview with the legend, that is Steve Berry. We've got a quick chat with a Kawasaki specialist, specialises in a particular make, that's Keith Ogden. We've got our top 10, and we've got a road test. This week, it's on the Kawasaki Z900 RS. But first of all, let's do a little bit of news. Well, apparently, motorcyclists have been verbally abused by members of the public for daring to ride their bikes in this last week since the lockdown measures were relaxed. Well, in England anyway. People just don't get it, do they? What a better way to self-isolate and keep social distancing than riding your bike? As long as we don't congregate at beauty spots, then what's the problem, eh? Now, MP and biker Dr. Julian Lewis has asked the UK government, why can't bikers use bus lanes? Good question, of course. I find it really strange that some councils allow it and some don't. It really needs to be addressed and a decision to be made soon. Okay, more news. I've noticed a lot of manufacturers and dealers have already started to offer big discounts on new bikes, obviously in readiness to the potential opening of bike shops, which could be as early as next month. I guess now is a good time to start thinking about that new bike then. Now, Harley-Davidson has announced that the new 2020 models, most of them, will be delayed to maybe 2021. That's new models. Like that funny enduro bike that they're thinking of doing and sports bikes. I think other manufacturers will also be thinking of doing this as well because it doesn't look as though there'll be any major shows this year, so there'll be no point in showing anything off. Now, sports news. Bosses at BSB, that's British Superbikes, are now looking to start the new season, if possible, in July, much like what they're doing with the MotoGP and World Superbikes. They're open to do the same. Let's hope it all happens. I'm really missing it. Okay, that's enough of the news for now. Next up is going to be our test. And as I said, it's going to be on the Kawasaki Z900 RS.
This is Fab Radio International.
Well, this week's quick road test is on the Kawasaki Z900 RS. That's Kawasaki's retro-style naked offering. Let's do a bit of spec on it first. It's a 948cc inline four-cylinder, double overhead cam, 16 valves, 6-speed gearbox. It's got 109 brake horsepower and 73 foot-pound of torque. It's chain drive. It's got ABS, traction control. It's got a slipper clutch, LED lights, 17-inch front and rear wheels. It's got a 17-litre tank. Seat height's 835mm, although Kawasaki do a lower seat, which is 35mm lower. It weighs 215 kilos. Kawasaki claim a top speed of about 140 miles per hour. Fuel consumption of about 48 miles to the gallon. And it's priced around £10,000. Different colours are different prices. And there is a bit of discount on these bikes. But £10,000 will get you any of them, really. Okay, so what's it like to ride? Well, it's nothing like the original one, that's for sure. Kawasaki have made this to look like the 1973 Kawasaki Z1 model. The original Kawasaki Z1. And yeah, from a distance, with one eye shut, on a dark night, it does look a bit like it. Certainly the original model was the same colour, the brown and orange, although the latest model is actually a copy of the 1974 Z1A, which makes sense, second model in both. Okay, the most obvious difference, of course, is that it's got a 4-into-1 exhaust. The original Z1, of course, had the 4-into-4. Apart from that, yeah, they've done a reasonably good job. They've kept the chrome clocks, the alloy wheels that look like sport wheels. Unfortunately, it's only got a single shock on the back. Obviously, Kawasaki thought they'd improve the handling by using a single shock rather than the original twin shock. Okay, so you sit on it, and like any other naked bike, not a lot happened in front of you, really. It's got the two analog clocks there and a little bit of a idiot light in between, just like the original, but not a lot else going on. Okay, so you start it up, and it feels throaty enough. It feels smooth. It's got rubber-mounted bars and pegs, so a lot of the vibration is kept well away from you. Having said that, at high speed, you do feel a little bit, but there's nothing uncomfortable. Okay, so the handling, uncomparable with the original model, of course. It goes really well. It steers quick. Suspension is more than up to the job. Maybe a little bit on the hard side, but plenty of adjustment on the front and rear shocks. The brakes are good. I would say reasonably good. They're not outstanding, but they're good enough. The clutch is light. Gearbox is crisp. It's got no flat spots as such, but I must admit, when you're using the throttle in the lower gears, there is a little bit of a snatch as you come on and off it, but you get used to it. It's just a little quirk of fuel-injected bikes in general, that. Okay, so the gearing's pretty good. 75 miles an hour in top gear is 4,500 revs, which is halfway down the rev range, and, you know, that's good. Not far off the gearing of the original 73 bikes. Now, the noise from the exhaust is typical Kawasaki. It's pretty quiet at first, and then as you open the bike up, apart from the induction roll from the airbox, you get a lovely sound from the exhaust. Now, having said that, a lot of owners have been tempted to buy the 4x4 aftermarket system, which look absolutely superb. The only bad news is it's around about £2,500 for that 4x4, which, on reflection, is 25% of the cost of the bike to start with. And if you wanted to spend a lot more money, you can. There's a lot of extras, not just from Kawasaki, just the usuals, like centre stand and grab rails. But the Japanese have jumped on the bandwagon, and they're doing all sorts of things, like twin shock conversions, chrome mudguards, everything to make it look like a 72-73 Z1. You could spend an awful lot of money. So, yeah, it makes a little sense, actually. If Kawasaki had carried on with their Z range instead of dropping it in the 80s, mid-80s, and then this is probably what we would have ended up riding, which is not a bad thing. Absolutely superb bike. And if you're in the market for any sort of naked bike, before you get your money out at any other dealer, go to Kawasaki and just have a go. You'll be pleasantly surprised. They don't make them like they used to, which, you know, maybe is a good thing. I can't see a Z900 RS ever being valuable enough, not unless you keep it long enough, but yeah, it makes a good buy. Now, being a naked bike, of course, there's no wind protection as such, but I must admit, I was quite surprised, though, how fast you could go without the wind trying to rip your head off your neck. There's no reason for it. There's no screen as such, although there is fly screens available for these bikes. In fact, if you go on one of the auction sites, you'll see there's many, many extras that you can buy. Now, I'm 6'3", and it fitted me quite well, although I did find it a little bit too small. My knees were hurting after 25 miles of riding. But anything less than 6 foot, and I don't think you'll have a problem at all. Now, the seat was quite comfortable. It's not the thickest of seats, and it's not the widest, but yeah, it felt quite comfortable. And of course, on a bike like this, you're quite involved, so it's not as though you're sat down like on an adventure bike where you've got nothing to think about, but apart from how sore your bum is. So there's enough going on to keep you entertained. Now, personally, I would have preferred a set of higher bars just to make it look like the old one and just give you a bit more comfort. But I suppose Kawasaki have had to compromise here and there, and they obviously think that's the correct position that you should be riding in. Now, as I said, it doesn't come with a centre stand, but there's one available from Kawasaki, and there is other aftermarket ones available as well. And it does really need one, even if it's to just adjust the chain and lubricate the chain. Now, the finish, yes, good. Kawasaki have reasonably good with their quality of finish and fittings, so you won't be disappointed there. Now, the brown and orange one on the first model and this latest one are probably the best colours. Kawasaki do make some alternatives, like a dark olive green and a black one, which has not been a particularly good seller for them. And if you're looking for a discounted bike, it will probably be one of those colours that you'll end up buying. But no, go for the bright colours. They'll be the one that people want in years to come. So all in all, an excellent bike. Can't really fault it. The only bad point, I would say, was that little bit of vibration. And I do miss digital clocks. Just getting lazy, I think. My eyesight's not that good anymore, but I do like digital clocks. The old clocks with the needles on just seem so hard to read. Well, they do to me anyway. So yes, an excellent effort from Kawasaki. Well worth the money.
on your PC, on your tablet, on your phone, and over here in the USA. Embrace the alternative with Fab Radio International.
So we're back with our chat and interview with my hero, Steve Berry. Steve, thanks for coming back. Now, I've got a bone to pick with you.
Oh, here we go.
I've put on loads of weight eating all them burgers because I couldn't resist.
Oh, the Rustler's burgers.
Yeah, I mean, how did that happen? I turned on the TV and somebody, Steve Berry, that advertising Rustler burgers.
Did you know it was me?
Of course I did.
There's another, he's actually a pal of mine, Sean Keevney, who's from Bolton. And he's a DJ on Six Music, and he does quite a bit of voiceover work. He sometimes emails me and says, "Is that you on, you know, whatever a commercial is?" And sometimes it is. But just recently, I've had people who get on a Jet 2 flight saying, "Is that you doing all the announcements on Jet 2? And I went, "No," I emailed him, "Is that you on Jet 2? He went, "Yeah, it's me." So we kind of done quite
which ones
a few.
Have you done? Throw a few names and do a bit of name dropping.
Centro Trains, Castle Cement, Rustlers, Britax, Camping Gaz. I was told I've been saying Camping Gas all these years, but they're a French company. It's Camping Gaz. It's like when we were told that we had to say SIF instead of GIF, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Because everybody else in the world said SIF.
Nestle instead of Nestles.
Yeah.
I've never eaten a Milky Bar since.
The thing about a Milky Bar was, though, it wasn't actually chocolate, was it?
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? It was white chocolate. Don't ruin me and my...
No, Dave, it's not chocolate. Oh, here's the thing. One of the biggest letdowns in my life was when I went to Daytona for Bike Week with the BBC. And it was Daytona my first trip to America? I think it was, yeah. It's the first time I've been to the States in my life. And I'd grown up reading American comics, DC and Marvel. There was a lad who lived just up the road from us, and he's a bit older than me and my brother, and his dad worked in the States, so he'd bring him all these comics back. And when he finished with them, his mother would bring them down in a cardboard box. I can't tell you how exciting it was, Dave.
Yeah.
Because back in the day, and this would have been the 70s, British comics were a bit rubbish. They were kind of the Beano and the Dandy. And here was, in this cardboard box, a world of, like, colour and glamour. The Silver Surfer, the Fantastic Four, Justice League of America, Spider-Man, with colour covers. Like, we couldn't believe it. And, of course, adverts for American products like American chocolate. So we get to Florida for Daytona Bike Week, and the first thing I want is a bloody Hershey bar. Because I've seen it advertised for so many years as a kid, thinking, I wonder what a Hershey bar is like. I wonder what a Baby Ruth is like. Because, of course, we know. So the first thing I do is raid the vending machine, along with the South African cameraman who'd grown up in South Africa on American comics. Absolute garbage. What a letdown.
They still are. Oh, Baby Ruth's are all right, but Hershey bars.
Yeah, but we have laws, Dave. That's the thing. Here in the UK, there are laws about what you can and can't call chocolate. Mm. In America, there aren't, so they can go, yeah, chocolate, and it's not even chocolate. And my point being this, a lot of your life and a lot of your direction in life, really, is when you think about it down to legislation, our generation had to have a 50. We were only allowed a 50cc, so we all went through that rite of passage of having our 50 and trying to make the 50 go faster. Then we were allowed a 125, or if you're a little bit older than me, a 250. And then you think, yeah, isn't it strange that so much of our life is decided by men in suits sitting in rooms going, what age shall we allow? What age shall we allow them to have a proper motorbike?
Yeah,
I mean, right. It's so different now, isn't it?
It is.
Young lads 16 aren't doing what we all did, which is to get our nifty 50 and put an expansion pipe on it and put a big carb on it and look for clip-on handlebars and all that sort of stuff in rear sets, put rear sets on it and stuff like that.
Well, they're still on scooters. They're just robbing people off the back of them.
Yeah, it's a shame. It's a shame that culture has gone, because you made, apart from anything else, apart from a lifelong love of two wheels, you made some of the greatest friendships of your life with them lads, didn't you?
You did, yeah, and still have.
Yeah?
Yeah. Still have. Well, everybody you met in those days. I mean, I was a bit different because I was in the motorcycle trade, so I met an awful lot of motorcyclists, and a lot of them still are my customers, yeah. Which is strange because they come in after 30 years as though they've never been away. And the first thing they say is, where's your hair gone, Dave? you're a lot fatter than I remember, Dave.
Isn't it weird,
30, 40 years.
Yeah. Isn't it weird, though? Legislators will try, they think, to make things safer for the young men. It is almost all young men.
Yeah.
That want these powerful motorcycles. And in the process, they make it more dangerous. Because I tell you what, my pal Nigel had, he had a sidewinder on his bike. Do you remember that?
Yes, the leaning sidecar.
A leaning sidecar, which is a way of getting round the regulations about what... You could have any bike, any size, as long as it had a sidecar. Now, obviously, the last thing a 17-year-old lad wants is a big Bosmar box attached to this. Bosmar were manufacturers of big, ugly sidecars. The last thing you want is one of them on your bike. So some ingenious soul thought, yeah, what if you had like a tea tray with a wheel on it and it actually lent when it went round corners?
And a hinge. You had a hinge from B&Q.
Yeah, but everyone who had one on forgot it was there.
Well, that's that's the perils of it, yeah.
Yeah, and clattered a parked car or hit a bollard or something like that.
We were giving them, when the learner law came out in 1981, we were stuffed to the brim with 250s, of course. So in an effort to sell them, apart from selling them for like 299 quid and still couldn't give them away, we fitted a load of sidewinders to help sell them.
Or... this is going to sound nuts to people, but Dave's going to confirm that this happened because a pal of mine did it. They used to take the piston out of, if it was a twin, a 250, yeah, they'd take one of the pistons out.
Convert it to a 125.
Yes. Like that was going to do the engine any good. Come on, it must have wrecked the engine, surely.
Well, usually the conrod was just smacking against the cylinder for a couple of miles, and after that it was a good night, sweetheart.
So, no, yeah. But there was a kit, wasn't there, Dave?
Yeah, there was.
You could buy
kits.
A conversion kit to blank off one of the cylinders.
Jock Kerr, do you remember Jock Kerr Engineering?
Yeah.
They did one. They were big on that, yeah. Very strange, really.
We found a way, though, didn't we? That was, it kind of, it encouraged a lot of sort of... ingenious engineering to get round the rules.
It did. Well, we're all tinkers in those days. I mean, we all tinkered with bikes, didn't we?
Yeah, everyone did.
Nowadays, they just buy something and then just run it into the ground and then get rid of it and hope that the PCP deal they bought it on might actually cover it.
Do you think these lads that can't... Somebody was asking me the other day about repairing a television, and I was laughing uncontrollably. I said, when was the last time you saw a TV repair shop?
Yeah.
When a TV breaks now, it gets thrown away.
Yeah.
And you get a new one.
Yeah.
Do you think that these lads, the younger lads, the younger generation of motorcyclists, do you think that they will eventually want bikes that they can work on themselves?
No.
And they'll look to older bikes?
No, I don't think it's ever going to happen. People on mopeds now or scooters, they just wait until they're 17 so they can get a car. I mean, there's not a lot to do on that age group anymore on a moped, is there, or on a scooter?
This isn't very positive, is it? I think, here's the thing, Dave, I think the same way we're in Manchester, everywhere you go in this city, you see the evidence that this was a city that was built because it was the site of the world's original industrial revolution. It is literally everywhere in the buildings, the statues to the great men of Manchester who built this city. This was the site of the world's first industrial revolution. And we went through a process where a lot of money and then a decline and all that sort of stuff. And that's the same as in my lifetime, I think. The motorcycle game. We both lived through a time where virtually every young British man would have a motorbike.
Correct.
You know, I remember being at sixth form college. There was a shelter for motorbikes at a sixth form college, and it was full of 50s and 125s and scooters and all sorts of stuff like that. Can you imagine that now?
No.
How many kids go into college now, 16 to 18, are going there on a powered two-wheeler?
No.
Very few. But in the same way that this city had its industrial revolution, there are cities all over the world that are having it right now, and they're going to be chock full of young men on motorbikes. Look at the sales figures, the most recent ones, Dave. I think for the UK, it's pretty damning. It's about 120,000 total powered two-wheelers.
107 it was last year.
Yeah. For the US, it was more like 350,000, which is still tiny for a...
I mean, at one point, and I think I said it a couple of weeks ago in the show, where in 2015, they sold 1.3 million in America, two-wheel vehicles.
India?
It, well,
23 million powered two-wheelers in a single
China?
Year. Yeah.
I mean, China are banned a lot in the main cities, but I think that's ending now because they've realised that that is the main mode of transport.
They're having their industrial revolution right now. It happened here in this city 150 years ago. It's happening there right now. And inevitably, they will go through the same cycle that we did, and young men will want powered two-wheelers. Yeah. It's happening in India right now. And then when they get to our age, they'll want, you know... When they get to our age, the electric car will, I think, rule the road in most parts of the world. And but people will have a motorbike for the same reasons that after the advent of internal combustion at the start of the 20th century, people would keep a horse.
Yeah.
For pleasure and leisure. Motorbikes, still unbeatable for that, and they will endure. We will not see the motorbike disappear.
I'd like to think so, Steve, but I'm not 100% sure. I'm not convinced it's all the way things are going, because, as I keep saying, the average age of motorcyclists are in the late 40s. And if we pack in, let's say, another 10, 15 years, who's going to take over?
When do you think you'll stop riding, Dave?
Well, I've got a good friend, Spencer Robinson. He was on the show a couple of weeks ago. He's 82 and he's still riding the wheels off me. So I use him as a yardstick.
82?
He's 82. Been around the world with me.
I did a piece on Top Gear with a chap called Len Vale Onslow.
Oh, right. Yes.
Who was then Britain's oldest motorcyclist at 103.
Yeah, that'd be
and
nice.
He was riding a Suzuki GP100. And he'd had an amazing motorcycling life. He'd had his own brand, the Onslow Special.
Yes.
He built his own bikes. He'd run one of the biggest dealerships in Birmingham for many, many decades and was still riding at 103. But he shouldn't have been, Dave. We went out on the road together. We got to in Sparkbrook, his business was, in Birmingham. Norton were there at one point, weren't they?
Yes.
Yeah. And we got to a red light and Len went sailing straight through it. He could have been killed right there. And then it was a busy road. He went sailing straight through it.
That's confidence of all them years' experience.
No, it was because he was 103 and should not have been riding a motorbike. So the director got very nervous because he was so unsteady on this Suzuki. And he said, let's just get the absolute bare minimum of him riding and then stop doing this. Because if we kill him doing this, it's going to look really bad.
Yeah, it wouldn't look good, would it? But 82, I'm thinking if I can do another 20 years, I'd be more than happy. But of course, once I get to 80, I'd be thinking, oh, if I could just do another 20 years.
I think I've had my last road-going race rep. I think I've done that.
Yeah, I've been there. I've done that.
Yes. There's a picture that a pal of mine, Nick and his missus, were on their way to Blackpool in a car to go to a motorbike show. Shame on you, Nick Liadis, Nick the Greek, long-standing pal of mine, long-standing motorcycling pal of mine. Shame on you, sir, right, going in a car. And they saw me on the way there, so they pulled in. They got ahead of me, pulled in front of me and took a picture of me, and it's a great picture of me on my old Ducati. And they sent me the picture and said, this is such a great pic. And I remember thinking, when you took that pic, I was thinking, I hate this bike. Because it was a real, it had lowered bars, it had raised pegs, and I was just thinking, this thing's agony. After about more than half an hour, this thing's agony. It looks great, but I've done my time on race. When I ride a motorcycle with pegs that high and bars that low, I want to be going round in circles on a racetrack somewhere. I don't want to be going on a 120-mile journey. You know, 250-mile round trip in a day.
Well, all my bikes I'm riding are like adventure bikes now, which suit me quite well. I was always into like the trail bikes, and so that's what I'm riding. But having said that, I've been testing a few sports bikes, and 10, 15 minutes is enough.
Yeah.
It is more than enough.
And there'll be some younger guys thinking, I'm never going to be like you old, you old farts. I'm always going to... A pal of mine, I've got to tell you, a pal of mine who's been involved in four-wheel motorsport all his life, worked at the very highest level in that sport, owned all kinds of fast and beautiful and exotic road cars, and got into motorcycling in quite advanced years, sort of age I am now. He must have been in his early 50s.
Mm.
And I warned him against the Ducati 748. I tried to do it subtly by just saying, you know, it's not the most comfortable. It might not be the gearing, the way it makes power, you know, the lack of any sort. And he's like, no, it's a beautiful. And I had to admit with him,
yeah,
a beautiful motorcycle.
Yeah.
Anyway, to his credit, after he'd owned it for a couple of weeks, he said to me, 20 minutes and I'm done. I'm like, well, yeah, mate. Yeah. Do you know what he bought? Triumph Bonneville. One of the new Triumph.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Triumph,
yeah.
Bonnevilles. Yeah. And he loves it.
Yeah, wise choice. Yeah.
Loves it.
Which is the big sellers at the moment, the Nakeds and the adventure bikes, which is just a reflection of the average age of motorcyclists. So that's why I can't see where it's going. All this money spent on making superbikes with electronics, more than like man to the moon and all the rest of it. It's just wasted, really. But we're paying for that. That's why they're so expensive.
Yeah.
So the retro bikes is where it's at. It's unfortunate because it's nice to see development of motorcycles, but...
Yeah, I was a bit disappointed in going to the NEC and seeing so many bikes. I said to a pal of mine, I said, everything's got wire wheels.
Yeah.
Everything's got wire wheels all of a sudden.
Yeah, which are a pain in the arse to clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the way it's going. That's what average age of a biker makes 1975 to 1980, the glory years. So whatever bikes were around at that time. But having said that, I mean, there's a big interest now in later, like 1985 bikes.
Yeah.
The first of the real superbikes.
What, GPZ 900R?
Yeah, GPZ 900Rs, yeah, yeah. And of course the two-stroke thing is coming alive again, with the KR1Ss and RGV 250s. Everybody wants a two-stroke.
Well, here's the thing as well. I totally understand it, because you can a normal person can build a collection of motorcycles in a way that a regular person can't build a collection of cars.
Yeah.
We're not old Jay Leno. We haven't got endless money and endless space to put them. But as you'd well know, you can get half a dozen bikes in the space that you can get a car.
Yeah.
So if you've got a garage attached to your house, you can have a motorcycle collection,
exactly,
because
you
can possibly afford it, although, of course, the prices are going a bit nuts.
Yes.
But you can certainly store them, you know, and you can store them at your property. I've got to a point where I've had 9 cars, and frankly, that's just a pain in the backside.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, keeping them with bad. Well, I had 9 bikes.
You know, I was spending a ridiculous amount of money to rent the space that I was renting to keep the cars, and it was, I thought, oh, it's conveniently situated off the motorway, but it was still the good end, the thick end of half an hour's drive away from where I am. So if I wanted to use one of these cars, I had to drive for an hour backwards and forwards, and then I'd look at the others, some of which would be covered in dust because they hadn't moved, and think, this is stupid. Mm-hmm. So I'm now down to 2 cars and 5 bikes.
And what bike do you use more than anything else? What's your favourite at the moment?
The one that's my favourite and the one that I use the most aren't the same thing, Dave.
Oh,
the
yeah.
one that I use the most is the BMW.
All right.
Well, just because it's here's the thing as well. The BMW is the one that's closest to the door. So if I want to get the others out, I've got to move the BMW.
Yeah, I have that problem. Yeah.
So I'll wheel the BMW out and think, oh, just go on this, because it's just such a smooth bike. It's so comfortable. Oh, it looks all right. It's got boxes, which are damn used. You know, I'm honestly perfectly prepared to admit that I've gone from wanting something that looked like it was doing 100 mile an hour when it was parked on the stand and set my trousers on fire occasionally, to wanting something that's smooth, comfortable, fast, and has luggage space and will start and doesn't drain the battery if you leave it on its own for a day or two, like every blinking Ducati I've ever owned.
And that brings us to the beginning of the conversation, where you didn't like BMW, so we've
full circle, Dave.
Yeah, full circle, full lifetime now. Well, that brings us to the end of that, Steve. I can't believe it's gone so quickly. Hopefully we might get a chance to speak again.
I hope so.
Thanks.
Might talk about motorbikes next time.
Maybe. Thanks very much, Steve.
This is Fab Radio International.
Now, everybody thinks Dave is stuck in the 70s. But just to show he's not, this week's top 10 is things Dave hates about that era. At number 10, Bernie Ins. That's nothing to do with bikes, Dave.
Well, it is and it isn't. Bernie Ins, if you remember that was the height of sophistication in the 70s. Everybody went there for their prawn cocktail starters, their steak bay meal, and then for dessert, the Black Forest Gatto. The point being is that they wouldn't allow you in if you was a motorcyclist. They just turned you away. If you went back the next day in your car, or walked in, then there was, oh, please come in, sir. I hated Bernie Ins.
At number 9, white socks above your boots.
How naff was that? You used to wear them stupid derry boots and all sorts and then put white fisherman socks over the top. Mainly British bike owners, but I must admit I did it myself. How naff.
At number 8, British bike owners.
Yeah, British bike owners with the Norvilles and the Tribsers and Tritons spending weeks polishing their alloy tanks. What did they used to say to us? Oh, you get nowhere on that Jap crap. Well, we showed them, didn't we?
At number 7, Belstaffs.
Belstaffs. Belstaffs are the reasons we got banned out of pubs. You always knew when a biker was in a pub, it was like an oil slick all the way to the bar. And they just rubbed off everywhere, and of course they stank Belstaffs. Big Italian now, it's like a fashion company.
At number 6, Avon Speedmasters.
Who in the hell designed a tyre with a square section? It must have been something to do with sidecars, but I had them on an old Kawasaki 500, which is a bad enough handler as it was, but square tyres, incredible. They even went on to produce some really good tyres. Don't know what went wrong with them.
At number 5, dealers.
Dealers, don't get me started on dealers in the 70s. They were so ignorant and, I mean, you couldn't get a test ride. No one gives you test rides on bikes in those days. You just chose what you wanted and took it. The servicing, they used to charge you 20, 30 quid. Don't sound a lot that now, does it? But in those days, it was a lot. And all they did was just flick some oil on it. Dealers.
At number 4, finance companies.
Finance companies, we call HP companies in those days. They were a right rip-off. 20% deposit, 20% interest per year. Incredible. We used to get away with it as well because everybody was desperate to buy a bike. If you bought a bike of £1,000, you'd end up paying like £1,650 back for it. Yep, they were the pits.
At number 3, helmet visors.
Helmet visors. They did everything. They kept everything out apart from fresh air. Do you remember them? You used to have press guns on the bottom of them. And there's no way you could just get them to seal. We used to use draft excluders, rubber sealants, everything. Ooh, they were rubbish. Having said that, I've seen some new helmets now, classic helmets, and they've got the same fastenings on them. Crazy.
At number 2, Isle of Man steam packet ferries.
Isle of Man steam racket, as we used to call them. Do you remember going to the Isle of Man in the 70s? From Liverpool docks. Those docks then were floating docks, so they used to actually put rope around your bike and lift it up with a crane and put it on the boat. Of course, the rope used to chew up everything, take the paint off your tank, rip your seat. And then even worse, they used to pump all the fuel out of your tank before you went and mix it all up in one big tank. You probably all used it at the staff who worked there. And even worse, they put the bike on the deck, so on the way to the island, you got covered in seawater everywhere. Ooh, the steam packet company. Steam racket.
And now, at number 1, diesel spills.
I think everyone will agree with me on that. Diesel spills. Every roundabout you came to in the 70s had a big oil slick, like a rainbow. Mainly from trucks, of course, because I don't think they even had fuel caps. People used to just shove rags in them. And every bend, they used to spill everywhere. Diesel spills. Used to be a good excuse for when you fell off, even if it wasn't on diesel. Used to blame that diesel spill on the roundabout.
So, that concludes our top 10 for this week.
Steve's Speed Shop is a place to discuss, debate and just waffle on about old and interesting motors, mainly, but not exclusively, of the internal combustion variety. We'll have auction reports, buyer's guides, show previews and restoration stories to inspire, excite and occasionally terrify. That's Steve Speed Shop with me, Steve Berry, here on Fab Radio International.
So with me today is another good friend of mine, Keith Ogden. Now, Keith's a leading expert on the particular Kawasaki model, the Kawasaki Z1R. So we're going to have a chat with him about that. In the spring of 1978, Kawasaki released what was going to be their latest and greatest model, the Kawasaki Z1R. The R, by the way, stood for racer, not that it was much of a racer. I think Kawasaki did this because a lot of owners of the Z900 and Z1000s were, by this time, customising with lots of bolt-on goodies like mag wheels, 4-into-1 exhaust, headlamp fairings, custom seats. So I think Kawasaki were perhaps thinking they could make a bit of money out of this. And, of course, there was a new model due which was the 1000 Mark II, so maybe it was just a stopgap. It was released at the same time as another iconic bike, the Z650 Custom, also in the same silver colour, metallic Stardust Silver it was called. Now, the Z1R was a very angular-shaped machine and incorporated a few parts that Kawasaki had not used before, a voltmeter and a fuel gauge, neatly packed inside that little headlamp fairing. Now, Kawasaki had gone back to a black engine. The original Z1 in 73 had a black engine, but it was always prone for the paint to fall off, so Kawasaki had treated this with a new process, so they felt confident that it'd be okay on this bike. Now, Kawasaki increased the carburetor size from 26mm to 28mm. They revised the airbox a little, and of course the 4-into-1 exhaust made a little bit of difference, but Kawasaki claimed an extra 8 brake horsepower from the original 82 of the Z1000. And to be honest, you could tell, it did feel a much faster, quicker bike. Now, in an effort to streamline it, Kawasaki had done certain things to it, like shorten the centre stem, which made it really difficult to put on the stand. And they thinned out everything, including the seat and the tailpiece. The seat suffered because of this, and after 50-60 miles, it was quite painful. But to be honest, because of the small 13-litre tank, nobody wanted to do more than those miles anyway, and you probably couldn't. In fact, 100 miles on a tank, you was doing quite well. The other big thing for this model was drilled front brake disc, and later on Kawasaki also introduced sintered metal pads in conjunction with Dunlopad. And this was due to the fact that people complained all the time about the Z1000 was just useless in the rain. So the idea, they put the calipers behind the forkleg to reduce any water getting to them, the sintered metal pads, and the holes in the disc, which dispersed the water. It worked, sort of, but it wasn't a great success. There was a lot of use of plastic on the Z1R as well, which brought the weight down a little. The front mudguard was still metal, but the rear one was now plastic, rather than a bigger heavy one that was on the earlier models. The 4-into-1 system had a quite a large collector box underneath, which did add weight. In fact, it probably weighed more than the 4-into-2. Also included was a quartz halogen headlamp, self-cancellating indicators, hazard light switch, and the kickstarter, which was now underneath the seat. The kickstarter shaft was still there, of course, but Kawasaki just blanked it off with a rubber plug. There were other slight modifications to various parts, but nothing else major. Now, despite Kawasaki's best efforts, it was a really bad seller. In fact, in that year it was introduced, 1978, the dealer I was working for, not Mill Kawasaki in Manchester, which was one of the premier dealers at the time, we only sold 3 bikes, and one of them was to me. And it went on for many years. It was a particularly bad seller. Now I'm going to ask Keith why. Keith, why?
The British public can't cope with change, and it was a massive, massive change to what they'd been used to. It was square. It was angular. It had really nice flowing lines, but they didn't see that. All they saw was this square house brick.
Well, of course, up to then, nearly all Kawasaki's all had like pear drop tanks, which became synonymous with the Kawasaki Z range. And this was obviously just, was it? What do you think? Do you think it was just a stopgap until they brought out new models?
I think they were in the middle of a flux, and they needed to regain the ground that they lost with the rest of the manufacturers. And they were in the middle of some massive redevelopment, and they needed something to put on the streets while they were finishing it off. It turned out that it was this cafe racer, off the shelf cafe racer.
Well, of course, by 78, I mean, Kawasaki had their own way for about 5 or 6 years, so suddenly on the market was Suzuki GS1000s, XS1100s. Later on that year, the CBX six-cylinder Honda. So I guess they had to do something, but obviously the Z1R just didn't do it for it. So for many years, nobody wanted them. I mean, they really struggled to sell them. What did Kawasaki do in an effort to try to sell them?
Well, they obviously took a step back and think, well, what have we done wrong? And listened to the motoring journalists. And the motoring journalists all slated it because it had a little tank, 13 litres. And so did most of other things. So, you know, I couldn't see the problem there. And the tank was built to fit in with the lines of the bike. It flowed from the fairing straight down the seat to the tailpiece. Other than that, I don't know.
Well, yeah, it was a small tank, really. I mean, I had a new Z1R in 78, one of the only 3 we sold that year at our dealership. And, yeah, after 100 miles, you were looking for a fuel station. And if you didn't find one within about another 15 miles, it was pushing it to the nearest one. But I guess in those days, not everybody wanted to do big miles anyway. There were no big tourers. No one had any aspirations to be travelling around Europe. So, yeah, I can't see the problem there. So it must have been something else. It wasn't just the UK. A lot of the other countries, they was obviously sat down scratching their heads thinking how they could improve it.
Well, I suppose the devil in me wants to say that the British public can't handle change. And it just looked too different. And it came at the end of a line, a pretty successful line from the Z1. How many different models did it? They put out a new model every year, didn't they? But the Z1R, if you took the paint set off it, what did you buy? What basically were you buying? An A2?
Yeah, basically it was just a Z1000 A2 with different paintwork. But like I said, with Germany, they put the 4x4 exhaust, they mangled a set of Z900 exhaust on it. And then, of course, Kawasaki brought out a big tank, because they obviously thought that was what the problem was. And then in America, it completely changed, didn't it?
Yeah, they started altering the frame rake, and they made the swinging arm a little bit shorter, and they changed the shock absorbers. They came out with a dual spring shock absorber initially, and they just put standard straight single springs on them. Basically, the dealers were screaming that they got showrooms full of these things and nobody wanted to buy them, and nobody could figure quite why.
Right, well, in 78, America had moved on to the 2 and the D3. I think there was even a D4, which basically had the Z1000 Mark II engine in it. Is that right? Did they do any other changes?
Well, there was never a D4. You were almost right. The D2 and the D3, they were just basically the upgraded Mark II engine. A few other bits and pieces. Obviously, the bigger tank and a 19-inch front wheel. From memory, I think they also altered the offset, the bottom yoke as well, just to give it a bit more rake. Basically, to calm down the motoring journalists that said it was like riding a camel.
Yeah, a camel or a pig on stilts, yeah. Now, they also put a 4x2 exhaust on it as well, which obviously they thought that maybe the 4x1 was putting people off, but one of the big sellers that we used to sell in our stores department in those days were 4x1 exhaust, so I can't believe that. Now, America went on a really big... Even though it was a pretty good seller in America, they obviously had bikes left over, so they went on a massive bolt-on edition, which was... well, you tell me what it was.
Oh, they fitted a turbo, yeah. So the damn thing was a maniac to start with, so, you know, why would you want to go faster to kill yourself? Again, the turbos are coming back with a vengeance. They could be popping out of garages all over the world.
Yeah, but in those days, obviously, a turbo kit was just an add-on, and it wasn't made by Kawasaki. It was a Regier turbo, and then Kawasaki got various companies to make various bits for it, and they just bolted it on, didn't do any modification to the engine, and even more interesting, Kawasaki didn't give any warranty. The normal 12-month warranty was suddenly void. That tells you something about what they thought that was going to happen in the long run, and I think they did. But they made quite a few of them. They made a couple of hundred of them, and they're the ones now that... are reaching stupid money compared to a standard bike. So while the Z1s and the Z900 rose in value over the last 35, 40 years, the Z1R stayed basically at the same price. Still nobody wanted them. And then about 30 years later, it suddenly caught on. Why do you think that was?
I think the answer to that one is pretty simple, isn't it, really? The market for the Z1Bs and the Z1000s is pretty much been overtaken now by speculators. So the price of them now is absolutely ridiculous. So what's the next progression? You look at what the next Kawasaki model was, and it was the Kawasaki Z1R. So, and it's going to happen all the way down the line, isn't it, with each model as they come along, the J's and the H's and the 1100Rs, all the rest of it. And eventually, it's just a natural thing, isn't it? People want to spend the money on something that's going to appreciate these days. They don't just want to get on it and ride it. Just my opinion.
Yeah, but my point is that the Z1R was such a bad seller when it was new. Do you think that, because there wasn't that many around, has made people think now, oh, it must have been, it must be a rare, valuable bike, because you don't see any? The truth being, you don't see any because Kawasaki couldn't sell them. So is that what makes a bike a classic?
I'm not sure what makes a bike a classic. I think the whole thing is subjective, isn't it? What you've got in your head. If you think it's a classic, then it's a classic. spending a lot of money on it, it doesn't make it a classic. But it seems to be the way it's going.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, at one time, a classic bike or a vintage bike always had like a date. You know, if it was 15 years old, it was a Japanese classic. If it was 25 years old and all that. But it's never been the same with Kawasaki. I mean, I remember the old H2 750s. Even after maybe 5 years, people, that's to say like in 1977, they were classing the 72 H2. As a classic, and that was only after 5 years. Again, that was because there wasn't many to start with, and people couldn't afford them when they were new. So that's just the way things go. Not all classics, as you say, are desirable bikes. It's all down to investment. Now, I've said many times that they sold very poorly, and there wasn't many about, but I was amazed at how many people actually own them. Now, you're quite au fait with the online Z1R Facebook pages, and they've got quite a few members. Do you know how many members they've got?
There's at least three or four different pages, and you usually find that people are members of both of them. But I bet you can count 500 or 600 Z1Rs kicking around up and about the world that people are either riding or restoring or polishing or whatever it is people do with them these days. But the best thing about it is that now they've retained some kind of status, that for folk like me who ride them every day and wear stuff out, all the old stuff that you couldn't get hold of, right, all the parts that would go, the braking components and the master cylinders and stuff like that, you can get them now because people are making them. And they're also finding out that Kawasaki were basically parts bin specialists, and we would fit anything to anything. So there's lots of stuff out there that went on other stuff, or other bikes, that will actually fit on the Z1R. So more and more people are getting them out on the road, which is good.
Now, the Z1R had the first, if I can think... No, it wasn't the first, but it was the first big bike to have a cable-operated front brake system. They were still hydraulic, but they had a cable from the front brake lever down to the master cylinder, and that was so they could fit the fairing, so it wasn't fouled by a master cylinder. But that proved to be really troublesome, and they just didn't work. Has that improved over the years?
Well, 2 points, because I clearly know something you don't. So, you know, yay to me. BMW used it on some of their early Boxer Twins. As for the Z1R, I never had an issue with it. I never had an issue with the cable-operated front brake. And I would opine that the people who do have an issue with it haven't set it up right. That front brake has never failed to stop me when I need it to at any time. So I can answer your question honestly. I've never had an issue with the front brake on a Z1R.
It was only the fact I came off as normal Z1000 with twin disc at the front to a Z1R, and that's the first thing I noticed, the poor braking. But perhaps it just needed a big yank on it. Although Kawasaki did modify the cable and the little lever at the bottom so you could get more leverage on it. But while we're on the subject, what else is bad on them? I mean, you right? How many? If you could tell me how many bikes you've got, and then tell me what you think is the bad thing about them.
I've got about five. If I know, I have got five. And the worst thing about them is that I'm old now and they're too damned heavy. But other than that, they're just a joy to ride. You just get on them and they do what you want. It's like anything else. It is a mechanical lump. You're the intelligence. So you get on it and you learn what it's capable of very quickly, or it hurts. And then you adapt your riding to fit what it's capable with. And it's just it's all technology and... Sometimes it's like riding a camel sat on a curbstone. And other days, it's just a joy to drive.
So you've not just got standard ones, even though, as usual, they're the true values in their originality, but you've got bikes that aren't in the standard colour, not got the standard parts on them, but you still enjoy riding that as much as the standard one?
I've got a couple with the usual mods that you did back in the 70s, rear sets and 4x4s. Noisy 4x1s, is that the correct terminology? Yeah. But I have three standard ones, but they all ride the same. There's not a great deal of difference in them. You just get on it, and away you go, and adapt your riding style to whatever you got between your legs.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I think I know what you mean. Now, originally they were about £1,700. I know we used to discount them to about £1,500. So, but that was about £300 over the price of a standard bike. And like I said, the values didn't go up for many, many years, but obviously they have now. So give us some idea of value, starting with just something that's rideable, but perhaps not standard.
Well, I've seen them fetching stupid prices now, but personally, I've never paid more than $2,500 for any of them. And the most expensive one I've got is the D3 with all the massive mods. Well, it doesn't ride any different, but to answer your question, they're fetching anything up to £10,000 now. And it's even one that you've got to start stripping down and completely restoring, or at least doing something to before you can take it on the road, is fetching £4,500-£5,000. Again, it's just a natural progressive thing, isn't it? People are buying stuff, and people are trying to get as much money as they can for it, and somebody comes along and thinks he's buying an investment, and then the whole thing just snowballs, as it did with the Z1s. And we all know how they ended up, don't we?
Yeah, that's true. But having said that, I mean, I've looked on eBay, and because I had a Z1R to sell, which I did sell, and I noticed some dealers were asking like £16,000-£17,000 from them. I know it doesn't matter what you ask for them, because all that matters is what you get for them. But do you think they were just chancing their luck?
Yes, in a word. You put a price on it, and if somebody comes along and wants to pay it, then you take that off him, and everybody's happy. Until the next person comes along, and the whole thing snowballs because, well, that one went for this, so mine must be worth that. They're only worth what people are prepared to pay for them at the end of the day. And I've got my own views on that, and it's not for this microphone, I don't think.
Well, you're right there, Keith. It's something I tell everybody all the time. It's only worth what people will pay for it, which is a good thing about auction sites like eBay, because that sort of tells you how much people are willing to pay for it. Anyway, Keith, that's going to be the end of our little chat. Thanks for all the information, and hopefully we'll speak again. Thanks, Keith.
Boris, нет, not for you. Hello. When I'm not plotting world domination inside heart of Kremlin, I'm listening to Fab Radio International. It's good, yeah?
So, that's the end of the show, and it's the end of the series. Now, we should be back in a couple of months' time with a new series. Hopefully, if you've been listening to this 12 shows, you'll come back and listen to those. So, just before we go, I'd like to say a big thank you to everyone, especially to Michelle and to Paul, our station manager. And I'm just going to ask Michelle what she thought. What did you like about the series, Shell?
I liked it all. It's a new experience. I quite enjoyed reading the emails that came through and answering the questions. And I think it's overall, it's been a very pleasurable experience. So what did you like about it, Dave? What did you find the best and the worst bits?
Well, the worst bits was doing it, being thrown in and doing it from scratch. Never done a radio show before, but I think we found our feet quick enough. The best bits, I like the interviews. It was great to see people who didn't think they'd be able to do it. They came into the studio and they just sat there looking at me, staring at me, unbelievably, after a couple of minutes of talking. That was it. You couldn't shut them up. And that was great. I didn't have to do anything. So, yeah, I really liked the interviews. Of course, I liked doing the test rides. It was a good excuse to get out on bikes and convince dealers that they should be letting me go out on these superb motorcycles. And yeah, it was a really good experience. I'm looking forward to series two. Not quite sure what the format will be on that series, but we can more or less follow off of what we've been doing already, I guess. What do you think?
Yeah, I think each time we've been doing it, it's a new experience for us both. We've both never ever produced or even done a radio show, so I think each week and each time we do one, we learn a little bit more. We probably sound a little bit better from the time we started, and I'm looking forward to the next one and coming up with some more ideas and taking it from there, really.
Yeah, so if you've got any thoughts on the next series and you want us to include anything, then maybe you can email us on our motorcycleviews.yahoo.com email address. But I tell you what's been quite difficult, Michelle, is this lockdown thing. We've not been able to go into the studio, so we'd only just got used to using the machinery there and all the high-tech stuff, and then we got thrown in from doing it from home, from the garden, social distancing and all that. But I think we did a reasonably good job. Do you?
Yeah, that was something that it was a hurdle we didn't expect. We had to jump. And I think we did it really, really well from a mixture of kitchen, garden, lounge and social distancing. It was a challenge and I think we managed it together.
Well, hopefully by the time that we do the next series, we'll be back in the studio full time. So yet again, let me just say thank you to everyone and we'll speak to you soon. Remember, stay safe.
Thank you, everybody, and please send in any ideas that you think that you'd like to see either an improvement or added to our next show.
Coming up next is The Ripman Show with Paul Ripley. He'll be playing music from 1969 to 1979.